Welcome to Technocratic Tyranny Blues. This is going to be a slightly different format today, so I'm back to doing playing documentaries and such like, which I haven't done for about a month. So it's time I got back to that. So the music show was good for a month. What I might do this year, what I'm thinking about doing, because I want to focus on power, corruption, lies, and money in January, what I'll do is I'll use some of the music show slots to do that. And some of the music show slots will be still be music. But I want to get some material into that particular podcast because I haven't looked at it for ages and it deserves attention. I went on a wild goose chase last night till about 5 o'clock this morning, listening to documentaries about Meyer Lansky. And I think he's a key player in a lot of things. So in terms of casinos and money laundering and Las Vegas, I want to look at all of those things over the next month. Cuba, which takes us to the Bay of Pigs and the CIA, and potentially to the Kennedy assassination. So all of these things, I circle around when I set up Power, Corruption, Lies and Money as a podcast. I knew that American organized crime would be part of that. But it looks like it's going to be a major part of it for at least the next month. So what I want to do is use this time to, while there's nobody actually here, to play the piece, one of the pieces that I was listening to last night, which is about 45 minutes in total. It's on BitChute. It's the history of Meyer Lansky. So, let me just see if I can find it here. Meyer is M-A-Y-E-R. Lansky is L-A-N for November, S-K-Y. That's M-E-Y, isn't it? Meyer Lansky. So let's just start. We'll start with one that I didn't listen to, which may turn out to be the same thing, but Mafia's Greatest Hits, The Mystery of Meyer Lansky, which is Season 1, Episode 12. It's 44 minutes and 12 seconds long, so that's about right for what I do on...
Benny Siegel, better known as Bugsy, was tall, good-looking, and charismatic. A charmer and a womanizer. He was also a gangster and a killer. He was a man with enemies. Late one June evening in 1947, he arrived at the Los Angeles home of his mistress with a friend. Siegel's mistress was away, and the two men made themselves at home. As with most mob killings, the murder of Bugsy Siegel was never solved. But the one name always associated with Siegel's death is the one name he would have least expected. That of his best friend, Maya Lansky. Maya Lansky was one of the most mysterious of all mob figures.
Little Maya, quite tough, but not really a violent man.
For some, he was the Jewish mastermind behind the mafia, pulling the strings from the shadows.
He was a financial genius of organized crime. He was also a killer on part of the New York mafia, and very powerful and very successful.
But for others, he was little more than a middle manager for the mob. His sinister reputation, the product of media hype and hysteria.
The cold hard evidence suggests that he wasn't quite the business brains that everybody thought he was, or that he thought he was himself.
Mob mastermind, or victim of his own legend, we unravel the enigma of Maya Lansky. Maya Lansky arrived in America in 1911 as an 8-year-old boy. He and his family were Jewish immigrants fleeing the brutal anti-Semitic pogroms of their native Russia.
He was scarred by what he saw as a small child. I think Meyer was rather focused on anti-Semitism and his belief that he is not going to lay down the way the Jews in Russia or Poland did, and the way he even felt his father did. And a lot of what Meyer felt being Jewish was not putting up with abuse and fighting back.
His family soon settled in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, New York's impoverished Jewish ghetto.
He grew up in a pretty tough district in New York. And whatever your size was, you had to be tough. You had to be able to take a big beating and give a beating. And so he was small.
Just 5'4", Maya Lansky quickly learned to use his fists and was soon in trouble with the law. It was at this time he'd first met another young Jewish hoodlum called Bugsy Siegel. The meeting happened when Siegel became involved in a street brawl.
Siegel had these charismatic good looks, and he got involved in a street fight. And he picked up a gun, and he was so transfixed with the fury of the fight and his anger that he raised the gun. And was about to shoot somebody. And they could hear the police coming from all directions. It was only when Maya sort of physically restrained him and pushed him away that he was able to. Save him, he said that was the beginning of that.
Lansky and Siegel's big break came in 1920 with the introduction of Prohibition, the ban on the consumption of alcohol, a ban which spawned a lucrative illegal trade for mobsters of all ethnic groups.
It was Prohibition that turned all of these low-level street predatory criminals into business executives, because they had to figure out how to manufacture, import, distribute, sell, run real organizations.
The Bugs and Meyer gang was soon carving a niche for itself in New York's brutal gang wars. And it was at this time that Lansky made what would be the second key alliance of his life, with Italian mobster Charles Lucky Luciano, a man whose respect Lansky first earned when they were teenagers, and Luciano tried to rob him.
famously, Luciano tried to shake him down, and Meyer told him, in no uncertain terms, in very colorful language, where he could get off. You think that because I'm Jewish, I'm just going to fork over money. That's not going to happen today, buddy.
It was the start of one of the most important friendships in the history of organized crime, and of a groundbreaking Sicilian-Jewish alliance.
Luciano really didn't like the old-time Sicilian bosses, the notion that you only stick with your own. A lot of the newer, younger Italians, they didn't really care about the cultural precedent for setting up a gang. It had nothing to do with Sicily. They wanted to make money, and guys like Meyer, who were Jewish, wanted to make money.
With Lansky at his side, Luciano was soon shooting his way to the top of the New York underworld. In the summer of 1931, just one man stood between Luciano and total control. Salvatore Maranzano, a classic old-style Sicilian mob boss. Luciano turned to Lansky for help.
One of the stereotypes of the Jewish rackets is the Jewish guys handled the money and the Italian guys were the tough guys. Not true. Interestingly enough, when Luciano took over the Italian rackets, it was the Jewish muscle that played a big role.
The idea was that if you use Jewish gunmen, we got very ethnic now, if you use Jewish gunmen, the Italian criminals wouldn't be so suspicious because they wouldn't look like Italian hitmen or Sicilian hitmen.
Luciano's bidding, Lansky organized a gang of Jewish assassins to visit Maranzano's offices on Park Avenue, posing as tax inspectors from the Inland Revenue Service.
One of the guys whose name was Red Levine, who was known for being an Orthodox Jew who would not kill on the Sabbath. But Maranzano was so bigoted that he felt if some Jewish bean counter IRS guys came to his office, they couldn't do him any harm. Well, not only did they do him harm, they killed him.
With Maranzano dead, Luciano became the king of New York and set about establishing the structures of the modern mafia. Meyer Lansky now sat at the right hand of the most powerful mobster in America. But he knew there would always be limits on his power.
Lansky could never be a leader for one reason. He could never be a member because he wasn't of Italian or Sicilian extract. He was a Jew and he knew his place. He was highly respected as somebody who had the ear of Luciano, who could talk to Luciano, and he was a great entrepreneur in criminal endeavors. But he was never a kingmaker or in a position of authority.
From now on, Lansky's role would be that of a chief executive in his various criminal enterprises. Powerful, but answerable ultimately to Sicilian bosses. By now, he'd married and quickly had three children, the oldest of whom, Buddy, suffered from cerebral palsy. Otherwise, life was good. He left the crowded tenements of the Lower East Side behind and took an apartment in the exclusive Majestic Building, overlooking Central Park on New York's Upper West Side. With the abolition of Prohibition in 1933, he branched out into a new business, one that would dominate the rest of his life.
Meyer Lansky was brilliant mathematically, and his real interest was gambling because he had a knack for it.
Lansky was good with numbers. And the whole idea of gambling is you got to be quick with numbers, you got to know the odds.
He could tell you if it came to craps, well, the proportion for the table was 4.5, and if it was blackjack, it was 5.2.
Gambling was illegal, but widely tolerated, and Lansky was soon running casinos in New York, Florida, and a number of other states. Paradoxically, his casinos made money because they were honest.
The tables would not be fixed because he knew exactly how to take his profit without cheating anybody.
You don't have to be dishonest to win. You have to have volume. As long as you keep gambling, you'll lose.
By the end of the 1930s, Lansky's casinos had made him a wealthy man. But the little Jewish immigrant from the Lower East Side craved something more than wealth.
Right through Lansky's life, there is this wish to be respectable. And right through Lansky's life, there is this feeling that he is not a criminal, that he is a citizen like any other.
There is no doubt that the American people need an adequate merchant marine.
How did Joe Kennedy make his money? What was the foundation of the Kennedy family fortune? Joe Kennedy was a bootlegger, and he was able to launder his fortune and use it to pay his son's way to become president of the United States. Meyer Lansky literally compared himself to Joe Kennedy and felt he was no more immoral than that man had been.
He actually had a snobbish streak. This was somebody who studied history. This is somebody, when his friends were out carousing at night, would hire tutors.
Lansky sent his own second son, Paul, to study at the military academy, West Point.
He would jot down, if he heard, saw a vocabulary word that he was interested in, you can see in his handwriting, he would write about it in a book. I remember one of the things he wrote was, determine how to pronounce Thucydides.
The attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, America's entry into the Second World War, provided Lansky with an extraordinary and unexpected opportunity to prove his patriotism and win the respectability he craved. In February 1942, a large troop carrier called the Normandy caught fire and capsized in New York Harbor.
The death of a queen. Now the $60 million luxury liner lies on her side, mortally stricken.
The Navy suspected sabotage. Many of the men who worked on the docks were Italian, a nation America was now at war with. When the Navy attempted to investigate, they found the waterfront an impenetrable, closed world. When the Navy approached him in 1942 to help them on the docks, Lansky immediately agreed to help. He arranged for Luciano to be moved to a more comfortable jail, closer to New York, and acted as a mediator in talks between the Navy and the Sicilian mobster.
It's an extraordinary story. Lansky says, can Luciano be moved? And then you see, because there was an official inquiry into this after the war, you see the actual document saying, move Luciano. A Mr. Meyer Lansky is going to come up and visit him. Do not request Mr. Lansky's passport. Do not take Mr. Lansky's fingerprints.
What then resulted was a deal where Luciano could meet with his men in prison, where he hadn't been able to do that before. And yes, he gave the order to cooperate with the Navy, but he also was allowed to conduct business.
It was an extraordinary deal, and it yielded almost immediate results. In June 1942, 8 Nazi spies were arrested following a tip-off from mob-controlled fishermen, an event later trumpeted by the FBI in this publicity film, although the Mafia's role in capturing the spies was not mentioned. The following year, provided the mob with an even more dramatic opportunity to lend assistance to the war effort. The invasion of Sicily, home country of the Mafia.
Meyer Lansky and Lucky Luciano bring Sicilian assets, contacts in New York, to naval intelligence and help design the maps, determine what the tides were, what good invasion locations were, beach terrain, and where Nazi strongholds were.
As American troops poured ashore in Sicily, the mob assistance proved invaluable. But the Navy knew it was playing a dangerous game.
The only thing worse than Operation Underworld, as it was called, failing, what if it succeeds? You're now in business with the mob.
Sicily was conquered in just 6 weeks. But this was not a story that the U.S. government wanted made public. The mob's wartime collaboration was hushed up. Charlie Luciano was released from prison, but immediately deported to Italy. As for Lansky, he found that in the eyes of the government, he remained a hoodlum. His patriotism had failed to win him respectability. And if he really wanted to leave the streets behind, there was another millstone hanging around his neck. Bugsy Siegel.
Siegel stayed on killing people, even after Meyer kind of slid out of this, what they used to call the Bugs and Meyer mob. Bugsy Siegel was a wacko. He was a crazy guy, and he did a lot of the... I never saw any indication that Lansky himself ever killed anybody. Siegel, on the other hand, he enjoyed it, and he killed a lot of people. Now, how many, I don't know. Could have been five, could have been 20.
Siegel had by now moved to California, where his film star looks helped gain him entree to the Hollywood set. But Siegel's dreams were focused elsewhere, a few hours' drive inland, a dusty desert stopover called Las Vegas.
There were these rundown gambling operations in this desert city, Las Vegas, that already existed there. What Siegel realized was these dusty, smoky, rundown places had potential to be something bigger.
The great advantage of Las Vegas was that it was in Nevada, the one state in the Union where gambling was legal. Siegel set about building his own luxury hotel casino, the Flamingo, the first in Las Vegas, with money borrowed from Lansky and other East Coast mobsters. The project quickly ran into trouble.
He never respected budgets. He thought that everything was limitless. And what starts as $1 million ends up becoming, you know what, it's not $1 million, I need three. You know what, it's not three, I need six.
The situation was complicated by the influence of Siegel's girlfriend, glamorous former dancer and mob courier, Virginia Hill.
No.
Her abrasive personality would later be displayed before a Senate commission on organized crime.
I never got money from any of those fellas.
None of those fellas.
None of these that I've been reading about and none that I knew, they never gave me anything.
Siegel's mob backers suspected Virginia Hill was stealing their money. But Bugsy Siegel was not the sort of man to listen to criticism of either himself or his girlfriend.
He was a very arrogant guy who would just basically tell him to go screw, you know, and he wasn't going to deal with these. He left it to Lansky to deal with these guys back in the East Coast.
Meyer pleaded with Ben Siegel to get things under control at the Flamingo, to start being more respectful of investors, to stop running around Hollywood going to parties. But you don't tell a 41-year-old man that you're not going to go trick-or-treating if you misbehave.
Eventually, the patience of Siegel's mob backers ran out. Just a few hours after Siegel's death, the Flamingo Hotel received a couple of visitors.
Two men, Mo Sedway and Gus Greenbaum, walked into the Flamingo and said, we're in charge now. And somebody said, well, this is Ben Siegel's place. And they said, Ben is dead.
Mo Sedway and Gus Greenbaum were both business partners of Meyer Lansky's. It is inconceivable Lansky had been unaware of the fate that awaited his oldest friend. 40 years later, after Lansky's death, Lansky's second wife, Teddy, was asked about the murder.
I think he felt badly for the family, and they were buddies from the time they were youngsters.
There were reports that he was involved in the death.
I don't believe that. Circumstances sometimes make you think, but he would never directly have anything to do with anything like that.
Directly.
That's right.
Lansky may not have ordered Siegel's death, but he benefited. For all that he craved respectability, this was the life he'd chosen.
I suppose we could say there's a hypocrisy here. In all my research into Lansky, I never discovered him being personally responsible, personally fingering, personally instructing the death of anyone. But he made his money and he worked in an environment where murder was the ultimate sanction and where those who failed to stick by the code paid in that way.
The image of Lansky as a dangerous mobster was about to become forever established in the public consciousness. In 1950, the U.S. Congress set up the Kefauver Commission, its first ever probe into organized crime.
You must have in your mind some things you've done that you can speak of to your credit as an American citizen. If so, what are they?
Paid my tax.
The commission focused primarily on the easy target of gambling, with the result that Lansky emerged as a far more important figure in organized crime than he was. Lansky was furious.
In one of the breaks in the hearings, Meyer said to Kefauver, Senator, I don't know what you have against gambling. You gamble. And Kefauver snapped, that's true. I do like gambling. I just don't want you people controlling it. You people. And one of the things that Meyer wrote in private notes is that gambling will become the biggest business in America once they run the Jewish and Italian boys. You people, out of it.
In fact, Senator Kefauver gambled on horses, which was perfectly legal. But for Lansky, it was another example of the hypocrisy of the establishment. The elite always looked upon gambling as an evil, Lansky wrote. Only when they used it as a pleasure or for the purpose of personal gain was it legitimate and not sinful. Once more, he felt he was a victim of anti-Semitism.
You just had to say Jewish financier in the background, working with Italian mobsters. He played to so many stereotypes. It was so damning to Meyer Lansky's reputation. He never recovered from it.
In the aftermath of the Kefauver Commission, there was a crackdown on illegal casinos of the type Lansky ran in New York, Florida, and other states.
Let this be a warning.
to all racketeers and gangsters that they of their ilk will not be tolerated in San Francisco.
For Lansky, his dream of respectability seemed further off than ever. But as one door closed, another opened. Cuba in the 1950s was Las Vegas by the sea.
Cuba was better. Havana was better than Las Vegas. First of all, it was closer to New York. It was close to Florida. They could bring these people on airplanes, you know, quickly, and lots of them. Bring the entertainers in. Have an open city with every kind of vice you can imagine, with girls and pornography and cockfights and whatever guys like. Havana was the best of the best.
Lansky was invited to Cuba in 1953 by Cuban dictator Fulgencio Batista to help run the country's casinos.
When Lansky and some of his friends arrived, they were welcomed because they would run straight games. And then from Lansky's point of view, how marvelous to come to a country where they are not hypocritically denounced, but their skills are recognized.
Lansky helped turn Havana into America's playground, where the elite could enjoy all the vices denied them in the newly moralistic atmosphere back home. Among those who visited was future President John F. Kennedy.
Did Meyer know John Kennedy from Havana days, from trips there?
Yes.
What was he looking for in Havana? Gambling, women?
You said the second one.
Oh, a lot of people look for that in Havana.
Oh, yes. He told them where to go for it.
Lansky now embarked on his most ambitious project yet, the construction of the Riviera Hotel Casino on the Havana seafront.
We know from the evidence of the Riviera Hotel that by the mid-50s, he was worth $17, $18 million, which was a lot of money in those days. And he plowed it all into bricks and mortar and air conditioning and gold tiles and so on. It's a wonderful hotel by the standards of the 1950s. It's the first to have air conditioning. You go inside the casino. It's a wonderful mosaic-tiled, egg-shaped room. Still, with all the glamour of a Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall film. And that's where he put his money.
It was the largest single investment Lansky ever made.
I think Meyer was focusing on Havana to clean up his fortune. That was going to be his Kennedy moment. Havana was legal.
But Lansky had bet wrong. By the time the Riviera opened in 1958, Fidel Castro's leftist rebels were closing in on the capital. In the early hours of New Year's Day, 1959, the dictator fled the country.
At first, the celebration was peaceful as shouting, cheering crowds surged through the city. Then the temper of the throng changed, and an ugly mob ranged the streets, its prime targets the symbols of the overthrown regime, the gambling casino, the parking meters, the homes and businesses of Batista's Corby.
The casinos were looted and then seized by the new government.
6 years of when Castro came out of the hills, Lansky lost his money, Pepsi Cola lost their money, United Tobacco lost their money, General Motors lost their money, all the big American corporations lost the money that they had. So the world's cleverest gambler, at the end of the day, made a bad gamble.
Lansky now moved permanently to Miami. He was almost 60 and in poor health. but his return to America coincided with a renewed offensive against organized crime.
Attorney General Robert Kennedy paints a grim picture of the rise of lawlessness under the Cosa Nostra, or Mafia. This he describes as the government of organized gambling, narcotics peddling, extortion, racketeering, and controlling of certain trade unions.
With Bobby Kennedy at the Justice Department, the government had the Mafia in its sights. Lansky was still regarded as the mastermind of the mob and found himself under almost constant surveillance.
Meyer is being dogged 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, by the authorities, by local authorities, by the FBI.
I knew them by heart. They were my buddies. If I saw them at the racetrack, I used to tell them, I'm going to report you to the FBI. You're not supposed to be gambling.
His wife, Teddy, one time was asked, did your husband have bodyguards? She said, yeah, the FBI. They were always there.
Listening bugs were placed in his house and at hotels he stayed in, but they yielded little. Spends much time lounging around his home, read this report from July the 7th, 1962. Main pursuits seemed to be playing gin rummy with friends, watching TV, and reading.
All those wiretaps, bugs, that the FBI did in the 1960s, every single bug was successful in getting good stuff, good intelligence for the FBI, except Lansky's. Lansky's was a total zero.
But the bugging did yield one conversation which has gone down in mob folklore. It happened on the evening of May 27th, 1962. While subject and wife were watching television, the FBI report read, TV panelists referred to organized crime as being second only in size to the government itself. Lansky remarked to his wife that organized crime was bigger than U.S. Steel. Lansky's exact words were not written down, and the tape was then reused. But the report was later leaked to the press. By the time the movie Godfather 2 was made in 1974, the scriptwriters had Hyman Roth, a character based on Lansky, narrowing his eyes and murmuring, Michael, we're bigger than U.S. Steel.
In fact, the record shows he did not say we are bigger than U.S. Steel. And of course, since it's not recorded, we don't know in what tone he said it. Could he have been sardonic? Could he have been sarcastic and saying, it's bigger than U.S. Steel? We don't know. But he himself would always say, when am I supposed to have said that? But of course, it stuck to him like a sort of catchphrase for the rest of his life and, of course, was finally immortalized on the silver screen.
March 1970, police finally managed to arrest Lansky at Miami Airport on drugs charges.
The drug bust in 1970, I thought, was a travesty and a joke, because basic charge was that he left the country to go to Mexico for a vacation, I believe, and had these drugs on him without having a prescription for it.
The so-called drugs were in fact medicines for a stomach complaint.
I thought it was pure poppycock.
The case was thrown out, but Lansky had had enough. For 40 years, he had sought respectability and acceptance as an American citizen. Now, he turned his back on his adopted country. In July 1970, he moved to Israel and applied for citizenship.
All through his life, he has had this pride in his Jewish identity. He takes pride in the creation of the State of Israel, which puts into practice the the toughness and the courage that he saw back in his youth in Grodno. And here's a whole country that embodies it.
The Americans were still pursuing Lansky and were pressuring for his return. The case was referred to Israel's prime minister, Golda Meir.
She didn't know Meyer Lansky from hole in the wall. And somebody said, he wants to be a citizen of Israel. And she said, fine, I don't see any problem with that. And then another one of her advisors said, you know, well, you understand he's in the mafia. Golda Meir said, mafia, mafia, no mafia.
Lansky's application for citizenship was denied, and he was expelled from Israel. Lansky's wife, Teddy, arrived back in America literally spitting with fury.
Now look, go away from me, I'll kill you!
Lansky himself was immediately arrested. The government had finally succeeded in putting together a case against him, a case that rested on the evidence of a low-level mobster turned police informant called Fat Vinny.
Fat Vinny was Vincent Teresa, who was a hoodlum from Massachusetts. He was, a thief and an extortionist, and he had been a federal witness in 38 mafia trials that the Department of Justice had brought.
Fat Vinny claimed that in 1968, he'd made two deliveries of cash to Meyer Lansky of income from the Colony Club Casino in London. It was a big break the government had been looking for.
Here's a guy who actually is willing to testify, who put money in Lansky's hands, $150,000. That's substantial compared to what his tax return said.
Like Al Capone 40 years before, Lansky was facing charges of tax evasion. Arriving at court, he was relaxed.
Are you pleased with the way your attorneys handled your defense?
I'm sorry, but no comment.
Well, you can't blame me for asking, can you?
No, I don't blame you at all.
Inside, the assistant prosecutor found a man very different from the one he had been expecting.
He was a gentleman, not a wise guy. It was clear that he'd read a lot. He was very articulate, very charming. If you didn't know any better, you'd think he was an executive of an American corporation.
The prosecution was led by a young Justice Department attorney called R.J. Campbell.
We felt that if he had to defend himself, we could really get after him, because I had a mountain of material to cross-examine him on. So I was ready, prepared long and hard. Lansky take the stand. He did not take the stand. What he did was put his wife on the stand.
Teddy Lansky produced receipts from a hotel to show her husband had been in Boston at precisely the time Fat Vinny claimed to have been handing money to him in Miami.
So, you know, we were hanging by our threads, right? Because once the witness has lied about one thing in his testimony, you are a gone goose.
It was a very thin case. We'd have been better off leaving Lansky in Israel.
Lansky was acquitted. The little man walked free. For some, it was further evidence of his fiendish brilliance. But for others, doubts were beginning to creep in that Lansky really was as rich and powerful as the government and the press claimed.
Let's put it this way, he lived very modestly. We never caught him spending much money on anything. He had nice suits. It didn't cost that much to buy a suit. He just lived modestly.
Have a good weekend. Yeah, okay.
So, mastermind of the mob, or as Lansky himself claimed, a retired investor living on a modest pension. Only in 1983 would the truth be revealed. Lansky died in his bed of cancer. His family gathered for the reading of the will. They too were hoping it would reveal hidden riches. They were disappointed.
I do believe there was a moment of recognition that, boy, this reality is very different than we thought it would be. Because to my knowledge, nobody in that family has a lot of money. And it's not because they secretly do and have hidden it so cleverly. I don't buy it.
I spent a lot of time with his crippled son, Buddy, who after his death was living on state charity, something Meyer had always tried to avoid in his lifetime, but he couldn't leave enough money for his beloved crippled son to survive. I think it defies the rules of human behavior that they would go through such denial of comfort for the sake of proving what?
Meyer Lansky never was the all-powerful godfather some believed. And he lost the bulk of the fortune he had in Havana in 1959. Under constant surveillance by the government, from 1960, he was effectively retired. And he spent most of what he had left on his various legal battles.
How would you describe yourself?
As a human being.
He saw himself as a victim of hypocrisy, even anti-Semitism. But Meyer Lansky never was quite the mastermind the American public believed. He shone only in comparison with other mobsters.
Most of these organized crime guys, they're not educated at all. So we're not operating from a very high plane. So a guy comes along like Lansky, who is quick and good with numbers, and he stands out. He's only bright in connection with the other people around him. He certainly wasn't in Bill Gates and Warren Buffett's league.
You know, the cold, hard evidence of Meyer Lansky, the businessman, suggests that he wasn't quite the business brains that everybody thought he was or that he thought he was himself.
Brand new and exclusive to yesterday, Mafia's Greatest Hits continues next Friday night at 10. Tonight, it's Into the War Zone with an enlightening look at...
All right, so that was Mafia's Greatest Hits on Meyer Lansky. Season 1, Episode 12, it says. So, I played it from BitChute. But the documentary that I watched last night was in three parts, and it was better than that. There was more information in it than in that. That was quite superficial, really. So there's another 43 minutes and 17 seconds is the next one on the list here. What I'm going to do, I'm going to play the three-parter simply because it was better. So let's go with that. So it's Meyer Mobs Accountant Lansky Documentary Part 1 is how you find it. Mobs Accountant in inverted commas.
The natural genius for numbers into a multi-million dollar gambling empire. High rollers made and lost fortunes at his casino tables.
And the $100 bills were that high. Oh, they were just incredible.
Did I enjoy it? Oh, sure, it was profitable too.
To escape the law, he fled halfway around the world, but it wasn't far enough. Meyer Lansky was born around 1902. Is unknown. His family lived in the Russian town of Grudna, a center of trade on the Polish border with a thriving Jewish community. Little Meyer studied Hebrew and went to this synagogue often with his beloved grandparents. But Jewish life under the Russian Tsars was not easy. As a boy, Meyer witnessed firsthand the brutality of the pogroms, the methodical persecution of the Jews by the Tsar's dreaded Cossack brigades.
When the Jewish community where he lived was suffering particularly, there was a young Jew who stood up and suggested that instead of just lying down, the community should fight back, that young Jewish men should go off to the woods and train and use weapons. And that appealed to Lansky, and all his life he had a chip on his shoulder. And that story was what he produced to rationalize what he became.
Meyer's family decided to flee Russia for the United States in March 1911. The ocean voyage was rough, but tough 9-year-old Meyer was too proud to be seasick in front of his mother. He went out on deck to get sick over the railing. For 2 years, the family lived in an apartment house in a quiet neighborhood in Brooklyn. When Meyer's father could no longer afford the rent, he moved his family to a tenement on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. There, more than 500,000 people, mostly Irish, Italians, and Jews, were packed into 2 square miles of crowded city blocks. Meyer got excellent grades in school, but when he wasn't studying, he was out on the streets. He was sucked in right away by the criminal world, and the most seductive part of that world was gambling.
A story Lansky always used to tell was of the night before the Jewish Sabbath in the Lower East Side, when his mother would entrust him with a pot of stew to be taken to the baker's oven, and he was always sent with a nickel to pay the baker for the use of the heat. And on the way, one night, he saw a crap game on the sidewalk, and he was drawn to put down the nickel. And of course, he lost it and had to go back home and tell everybody there'd be no hot stew the next day. And he always described the shame of that moment, but more than the shame, his anger at having been so stupid.
Lansky resolved that he would never be the sucker again. He had discovered that he had a remarkable gift for numbers. He could calculate in his head the odds and the payoffs from games of chance. He started running backroom crap games, taking other suckers' money and stuffing it into his mattress. By the age of 16, he had quit school, and he had a tough enough reputation that older hoods hired him to be what was called a shtarka, Yiddish for enforcer. His principal work was on behalf of local unions, beating up scabs, the men who worked in factories during strikes. But Lansky had greater ambitions than being a small-time hustler, and the ghetto soon offered him two partners who would pave the way to the top, Ben Siegel and Charlie Lucky Luciano. He won over Luciano after Lucky and his gang of Italians cornered little Meyer on the street and threatened him. Meyer called their bluff.
The stories he used to tell it was that he said to Luciano, who was the head of this gang, go f*** yourself. And suddenly, Luciano was confronted by a weak-seeming little Jewish boy who wouldn't lie down, who wouldn't be pushed around. And that was the beginning of the friendship between Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky.
Lansky met Ben Siegel when he helped the handsome young hoodlum escape from the police after a gang brawl. Together with Ben, known on the street as Bugsy because of his psychopathic rages, Lansky formed his first street outfit, a troop of Jewish hoods called the Bug and Meyer Gang.
Meyer was the brains, Benny was the brawn. He was the unguided missile, and Meyer was the guidance system, who would use him, cynically often, in later life, for what he wanted to accomplish.
With Siegel as his strongman, Lansky directed the work of the young gang, robberies, extortion, and as always, gambling. When Prohibition began in January 1920, they moved easily into bootlegging, shipping illegal whiskey into the States from Canada and England. But Lansky was still small time. What he needed was a mentor. Then, at a bar mitzvah in 1921, Lansky met the veteran bootlegger and schemer, Arnold the Brain Rothstein. Rothstein was widely regarded as the cleverest gangster in New York. He financed deals and let young hoods like Lansky and his buddies take the risks on the street.
Meyer Lansky worked for him. Lucky Luciano worked for him. Ben Siegel worked for him. Frank Costello worked for him. Legs Diamond worked for him. And I think that was how Lansky made the next step, the next jump.
Rothstein taught Lansky when the bribe was more effective than the bullet, and Lansky expanded his tiny chain of gambling parlors while the cops looked the other way. Then, in November 1928, Arnold the Brain was murdered. Lansky wasn't involved, but the killing allowed Meyer and his pals to go big time.
With the death of Rothstein, They're looking at the Rothstein Empire and the viable role they had played in some segments of it, and they can say to themselves, it's now all ours.
It would not be long before Rothstein's students became masters of gangland New York, but it would be Meyer Lansky alone who inherited Rothstein's special mantle. Lansky would become the next great mafia brain. As the Roaring Twenties roared to a close, the New York rackets were firmly under the control of Meyer Lansky and his mob cronies. Every mobster had his specialty. Lansky's was gambling. But to run a high-profit casino, Lansky needed help from communities that would turn a blind eye to illegal betting in exchange for a piece of the action. One such town was Saratoga Springs in upstate New York. In the late 1920s, Lansky's mentor, Arnold Rothstein, had introduced him to Saratoga. By day, rich and poor risked their money downtown at the world-famous racetrack. At night, the betting moved to opulent nightclubs called lake houses, early predecessors of the Las Vegas casinos. Lansky ran the gambling rooms in two of the finest lake houses, the Piping Rock and the Arrowhead Inn. There, he fine-tuned the persona that he would use for his entire career. Quiet, soft-spoken, and honest.
One thing a real dyed-in-the-wool gambler looks for is a fair gambling operation. And Meyer was always fair. He abhorred bust-out joints. That's where they rigged up roulette tables with a battery operation or phony dice, what they call top or bottom or slice dice. Meyer would have none of it. He insisted on a fair, honest game, and that's how he built his reputation.
Not to mention a modest fortune. By his late 20s, hundreds of thousands of dollars were passing through Lansky's hands, and like many successful young businessmen, Lansky decided to settle down. In the spring of 1929, Lansky married a beautiful young Jewish woman, Ann Citrin. Ann was a friend of Bugsy Siegel's girlfriend, Esther Krakauer. The couples double-dated, and when the Lanskys got married on May 9th, Bugsy served as witness. At first, Meyer was happy with domestic life, and Ann was content, shopping along Fifth Avenue for their new home.
But the reality of his life, away at strange hours, not being able to confide in anybody, poisoned his ability to have any sort of decent personal relationship.
The birth of their first child, Buddy, only made the situation worse. Buddy suffered from cerebral palsy and could scarcely use his legs. Ann Lansky blamed her husband.
God punish you for doing the rotten criminal things you're doing, and he visited your sins upon our boy. Okay? Now, whether it's true or not, subconsciously, Meyer had a guilt complex.
Lansky was desperate to cure his son. He read medical journals. He rented an apartment in Boston so Buddy could be treated by a doctor there.
So you have this dichotomy. He's pouring his love and the positive side of his feelings and emotions into trying to make some redemption of his son's life. And then he's criminal.
One of the most powerful criminals in New York City. Unlike other gang leaders, Lansky was learning to avoid the vendettas and police attention brought on by mob violence. Instead, he consolidated his power with his own personal method, fairness.
In the underworld, a handshake from Meyer Lansky was worth more than the strongest contracts that a battery of lawyers could put together, dotting the I's and crossing the T's with the whereases and the therefores. He was a man whose word was good.
He also chose a lifestyle opposite to that of his partners. Ben Siegel was a consummate ladies' man. Lucky Luciano basked in his gangster reputation. But Lansky dressed and lived quietly. He was fastidious in his personal habits. His fedoras were always placed carefully on their hat stands. His pressed shirts on their monogrammed hangers in his closet.
I'm telling you, he was as low-key as they come. And shy and retiring. If you can visualize Meyer to be a shy and retiring, and he was shy and retiring.
But when it came to doing business, Lansky could be just as ruthless as his murderous cronies. In 1931, Meyer helped his pal Lucky Luciano take over the New York mob. To do it, Lucky had to eliminate the two rival bosses at the time, Salvatore Maranzano and Joe the Boss Masseria. Lucky had no trouble bumping off Masseria, but Maranzano was a harder target. He trusted no one, especially not young Italian climbers like Luciano. that's where Lansky came in. Meyer's Jewish gunmen were the ones who turned up at Maranzano's office.
They were dispatched by Meyer Lansky. They said they were agents from the Treasury Department, and they were going to have to take a look at the books. And Mr. Maranzano came out and read Levine. Very close to Meyer Lansky was one of the gunmen who shot Maranzano. They also stabbed him, and they departed.
With the bloodshed over, Lucky Luciano was king of the hill, and standing beside the throne was Meyer Lansky. Excluded from the Italian mafia because he was Jewish, Lansky was now calling the shots in New York anyway, as Luciano's right-hand man. But just as Lansky had reached this pinnacle, his triumph was cut short. In 1933, Prohibition ended, and with it the stream of cash that bootlegging had delivered to the mob. And an even greater setback for Lansky came in 1936, when Lucky Luciano was found guilty of running prostitution rings in Manhattan. Lucky was sentenced to 30 to 50 years in prison.
When Luciano was put away, the New York police authorities mentioned six people that they thought might take over, and Lansky, whose name was misspelt, was mentioned.
Lansky was smart enough to say to his friend Ben Siegel, "You and I are going to be next."
Siegel headed west to Hollywood. Lansky headed south to scout out gambling opportunities in new and fertile terrain, Florida. What Lansky wanted was a location to set up his next generation of gambling houses, and he fixed his eye on a beach town just across the county line from Miami, the village of Hallandale. Officials there were especially forgiving of illegal betting. Well-run casinos would draw the tourists. The only problem, these games were already controlled by a local gangster. Lansky was going to need help muscling in, but he was having trouble recruiting new thugs from his old neighborhoods.
The era of the young, tough guy Jewish gunman is coming to an end. These young Jewish boys now are now going to be looking to go to law school, to go to medical school. So at that point, you can see that every enterprise that he gets involved in, he's got to have an Italian partner.
The key partner, Vincent Alo, better known as Jimmy Blue Eyes. Alo made the Hallandale gambling impresarios an offer they couldn't refuse. He told them that, whether they liked it or not, Meyer Lansky was taking over. Lansky built three casinos and put his brother Jake Lansky in charge. Then he smoothed all the ruffled feathers.
Anything that could be paid off with money, Meyer did not fear. Because as long as you could pay off somebody or pay something somehow, that was satisfied him.
For a start, Lansky paid every single family in town $35 a week to tolerate the casinos and to stay away from them. At the time, Joseph Van was the Hallandale city attorney. He too benefited from Meyer Lansky's generosity.
I go to a gambling joint on Saturday night, so I'd play a little bit, and they see that whether I won or not, they'd give me a stack of chips.
Florida gambling boomed. Lansky maintained his Saratoga tradition of spectacular shows and top-quality food.
They were places that were patronized by the finest people and had seating capacity, some of them as high. As 800 people, and some of the finest people of the United States patronized these places.
The trademark Lansky honesty brought in high rollers from all over the country.
And the $100 bills were that high. Oh, it was just incredible. I know one fellow by the name of Joe Milstein. One week, Joe Milstein lost $800,000, all in cash. Now, that's just one player. The house extracts a certain amount of every play, and as a result, their take was monumental.
Did I enjoy it? Oh, sure, it was profitable, too.
Profitable because Lansky and his partners were extracting millions in illegal earnings out of casinos protected by the New York Mafia. But as Lansky was making his mark in the tropics, a shadow was looming over the rest of the world. The rise of Adolf Hitler in Germany was a painful reminder for the Russian-born Jew of his family's struggle with oppression. On his trips to New York, Lansky began to sniff out rallies of like the German-American Bund,
Then he would show up with a truckload of goons and break up the rally. But his big chance to be a part of the war effort came when Navy intelligence decided to join forces with the mob to keep the New York docks clear of Nazi saboteurs. The Navy knew that the Sicilian Mafia controlled the waterfront and figured that even in prison, Meyer's pal Lucky Luciano still controlled the Sicilians. Only one man could take the Navy's request to Luciano, Meyer Lansky. "I'll help you," the little man told the Navy brass. "It's patriotism." Over the next year, Lansky met with Lucky in prison a dozen times. And in fact, there was no sabotage on the waterfront. More importantly, Lansky used the meetings to solidify his connections with the Italian mob. After the war, Lansky took his second eldest son, Paul, on a cross-country drive to Las Vegas. The purpose of the trip? To keep tabs on the man Paul knew as Uncle Ben, Bugsy Siegel.
I think my grandfather knew, with the other partners involved with Ben, that he had to keep a real close visual eye on Ben to make sure that his nature, not his intelligence, but his nature didn't kind of stray. Because let's face it, he'd like to have a good time, and sometimes that gets in the way of business.
It had always been Meyer who kept Bugsy under control, and Bugsy was way out of control now. With Mafia money, Siegel was trying to make Las Vegas a gambling mecca on the same scale as Florida, starting with the construction of the luxurious Flamingo Hotel. But cost overruns were draining the Mafia's money. Bugsy was running the Flamingo into the ground before it even opened. Only months after Lansky's visit, Siegel was shot to death in Los Angeles.
That could not be done without Maya Lansky being aware of it. He had to at least reluctantly nod his head.
Lansky always denied signing off on Siegel's murder. "I loved him," he was to say later. "And as long as he listened to me, he stayed out of trouble." Benny Siegel was dead. Lucky Luciano was also gone, released from prison and deported to Italy. Meyer Lansky was the last of his New York threesome left standing in America, and he had only begun his rise to the top as the mob's foremost tycoon. By the late 1940s, Meyer Lansky had consolidated his Florida gambling empire. He was making millions from the tourists who gambled at his glamorous casinos near Miami. And he was sending millions north to his partners in the New York Mafia, who provided the muscle to back him up. But there was one partner he could not manage, his wife, Anne. The couple now had three children, Buddy the eldest, Paul, and a daughter, Sandra. Lansky, always on the move between his Florida casinos and his New York headquarters, wasn't around much. Anne Lansky, forced to manage the family almost on her own, had not been up to the strain. Anne divorced Meyer in 1947. Soon afterwards, she was placed in a mental hospital.
She would just sit in the corner in a little room in New York City and maybe recognize you, maybe not. You know, just has no conception of time. You know, you haven't seen her for 10 years. You go knock on the door, she might tell you to leave. Come back later.
After the divorce, Meyer made a greater effort to play family man. He was especially concerned that his disabled son Buddy make new friends. So Meyer enlisted the help of a hospital volunteer who'd met Buddy during physical therapy sessions, Vincent Mercurio. Lansky himself soon took a liking to Mercurio and offered him bits of advice when the threesome went out for ball games.
"Do you gamble?" he asked me. I says, "No." He said, "And never start." He said, "Because you're always going to lose." And I trusted his judgment because, I mean, you're talking to the guy that's on the top of this, and he knew what the percentages were.
When asked by friends, Lansky would reluctantly recommend only one casino game.
"Blackjack." He said, "Because you have a 17.5% chance of winning." He said, "But the others are all sucker games."
In 1948, Lansky's games hit a snag. Americans were turning against gambling. Towns like Hallandale withdrew their support. One by one, Lansky's casinos were shut. But Lansky could ride out the crisis. He had stashed millions away. And for once, Lansky's family life seemed to be going well. His son Paul had even been accepted by West Point.
"Extremely proud of that. That's like playing ball for Notre Dame to my grandfather. You know, your kid is there. Your son made it."
And in 1948, Lansky got married for the second time to a manicurist he'd met in Florida, Teddy Schwartz. But when Lansky arrived home from his honeymoon in Europe, there was unpleasant news. U.S. Senator Estes Kefauver had brought his traveling investigation of organized crime to New York. Lansky learned that Vincent Mercurio,
staying with Buddy at the Lansky's New York home, had accepted Meyer's subpoena at the door.
He said, that's great. He says, did Vince open the telegram? Tell him to go for me. So I met him, and he says, you want to go down for me instead? I says, no, thank you. He says, why? I says, I don't know what to say. He just sit there and say yes and no.
Which is exactly what Lansky did. He pled the fifth. But the hearings were televised in time. Lansky's place at the center of the organized crime world was on public display. The investigation concluded for the mob tycoon with a Florida indictment for illegal gambling. Joseph Varon, who had now signed on as Lansky's personal lawyer, told his client to fight. But Lansky, afraid that he might have to testify against his friends in the mob, wanted to plead guilty.
I said, look, there's a way I can get out of this by paying $1,000 fine. So let's pay a fine. I said, Meyer, but the other boys that are going to be indicted with you, you're giving them criminal records and you're giving yourself a criminal record. What's $1,000 fine? Pay it.
A year later, he was indicted again, this time in Saratoga Springs. Again, he avoided testifying by pleading guilty. This time a fine wouldn't be enough. Lansky spent 3 months in the county jail. Released in August 1953, he decided it was time to take his gambling racket out of the country. He went south, all the way to Cuba, where gambling was legal and mobsters were welcome. And in 1953, Cuba needed Lansky just as much as he needed a safe haven. Lansky had been dabbling in Cuban gambling for years, but now the Havana tourist industry was threatened by scandal. Many of the casinos were exposed as using doctored games to cheat tourists. To restore international faith in the Cuban casinos, President Fulgencio Batista turned to the one man whose reputation for running a fair game was impeccable, Meyer Lansky, and offered him a job as gambling czar. The little man took the job with gusto and told the other casino operators, clean up or get out. With Lansky at the helm, Cuban tourism exploded. Lansky invited his mafia pals to invest, and many did.
The Americans were pouring in there, other nationalities were pouring in there. Meyer made a fortune.
Lansky made sure he stayed in the good graces of President Batista.
I know that every time Meyer went to Cuba, he would bring a briefcase with at least $100,000. So Batista welcomed him with open arms. The two men had such an affection for each other. Batista really loved them. I know because he brought, I guess I'd love him too, gave me $100,000 every time he saw me.
Lansky rented a third home in Havana. He ran one major casino of his own, the Nacional. There he resumed his traditional role, the quiet commander, pacing the casino floor and watching the dollars roll in.
And you could almost get the sense of people turning and looking and knowing who he was and not saying anything to him, but sort of like the Red Sea's parting. People don't have to tell you, you just, you know, who's who. And he was somebody.
At the Nacional, Lansky was fussed over by the staff, including waiter Jorge Fernandez, and constantly protected by a team of bodyguards.
They would be reading the Havana Post, a newspaper printed here in Cuba. But across their laps, they had a little Smith & Wesson, a little revolver you could not see. It was in case someone should make an attempt on the life of Meyer Lansky. That was who they were protecting.
Cuba looked like a sure thing. So in 1956, the man who warned his own friends not to gamble placed his biggest wager yet.
He pulled all this money together to actually invest further, reinvest, like the good businessman, in this wonderful hotel, the Riviera, which was in its day and remains the best hotel in Cuba, the most comfortable, the first one with central air conditioning instead of all those little boxes in the windows dripping water down.
Lansky began spending more of his time in Cuba, away from the grip of American investigators. But even the mafia tycoon couldn't stay out of the law's clutches forever. In October 1957, New York mob boss Albert Anastasia was murdered in a Manhattan barbershop. New York police knew that before his death, Anastasia had been looking to invest in Cuban casinos. So they wanted to question Meyer Lansky. Learning that Lansky was making a short trip to New York, the police pounced.
Lansky was arrested and questioned about Anastasia. He denied any knowledge of the murder.
I couldn't tell him anything. I know nothing about it. It was just as foreign to me as would be to an Eskimo in Alaska.
As an excuse for questioning Lansky, the police charged him with vagrancy, a technicality that the millionaire found especially offensive.
Do you pay taxes in the United States?
Oh, yes. Very dearly. But I'm a vagrant.
The police put a tail on Lansky. Detective William Graff settled down in the lobby of Lansky's hotel. Within minutes, Lansky approached the cop. He said he wanted to confess to a problem.
I know he was playing with me. No two ways about it. And I finally said, I can't get good chickens in Cuba. I said, what? Good chickens in Cuba? And then he explained that he had a problem getting chickens to feed his guests at the hotel.
The poultry shortage did not stop the Riviera Hotel from being a huge success. Lansky's gamble was paying off.
He spared no expense because here he was, legitimate, and could see this whole world of Caribbean tourism expanding. What he didn't reckon on were the guys with beards in the hills.
For 3 years, Fidel Castro and his ragged army of revolutionaries had been running raids on Batista's military from their hideouts in the mountains. On New Year's Eve 1958, just 1 year after the Riviera opened, Castro's forces took control of Cuba's major cities. Batista fled. The next day, Castro entered Havana. Rebel troops took over the casinos, including the Riviera.
In January, when my wife and I went there at the Riviera Hotel, there were Castro's men sleeping in the hallways, making a barracks out of it. These filthy soldiers with their beards, and it's just pathetic. And that's, I think that hastened Meyer's illness because he had a heart condition and a stomach condition.
A year after the revolution, Castro banned gambling and declared the casino hotels the property of the government. Once again, Lansky was out of business. He had sunk almost his entire fortune into the Riviera Hotel, only to have it taken away gangster style at gunpoint. Now, the mob tycoon was going to have to find a new way to make his millions back. After Fidel Castro took over Cuba and evicted the American gangsters from their casinos, Meyer Lansky was at the lowest point of his career. Gone were the millions he had invested in the Havana Riviera Hotel. While he was delighted by the arrival of his first grandchild, respectfully named Meyer II by Lansky's son Paul, his health was deteriorating. In 1962, he suffered a serious heart attack. Worse, Lansky had now become a target in a clandestine FBI operation. Unauthorized.
All right, that's the end of the second part of that Meyer Lansky documentary. So let me just find part three. It's only about another 15 minutes to run, so I might as well just play the whole thing. Part 3. 12 minutes 36 seconds. Here we go.
Prized bugs were installed in the homes of leading mobsters around the country, including Lansky's new ranch house near Miami. One night, the agents overheard Lansky remark to his wife that organized crime was, quote, bigger than U.S. Steel. That was precisely what the Fed suspected. They saw Lansky as the chief financial officer of a vast secret mob corporation. Other wiretaps seemed to support that impression, especially the surveillance of a New Jersey mobster named Anthony Gyp DiCarlo. On tape, DiCarlo boasted that Lansky had reopened his connections to Nevada gambling, was heavily involved in skimming profits from Las Vegas casinos, and was once again making millions. But Meyer was still safe from arrest. Since the bugs were unauthorized, the feds couldn't use the evidence against the mob tycoon. The FBI had to watch as Lansky went about his daily life, strolling through Miami Beach, having coffee in the afternoon, and going to clubs at night. One act he saw over and over was Jewish comedian Jackie Mason, who came frequently to Miami to perform.
I couldn't get over that this top man from the whole mafia is following me around.
I knew he wasn't trying to kill me, so I figured he must be enjoying my act.
After shows, Mason would join Lansky and his friends at their table.
He loved the power. I could see he loved the power, because when people sat around him with that worshipful look on their faces, you could tell that he knew he was the boss and he acted it. I used to say to him, how much money do you really have? I'm sweaty about my life, I'll keep my mouth shut. And he would laugh and change the subject or give me a hug or give me a kibitz, and I could never find out anything.
The FBI was having the same problem. Lansky was proving to be an elusive target. So the FBI put together a team of agents called a strike force dedicated solely to nailing Lansky. At the helm was a young prosecutor named R.J. Campbell.
One of the problems we had in dealing with Lansky was he was pretty much already retired. With maybe a quotation marks around the word retired. But he wasn't doing anything. He wasn't out committing anything which even close to a crime, say.
That didn't stop him from being one of the most famous underworld figures in America. His daily walks with his dog Bruiser made him easy prey for any photographer. Then, in March 1970, as Lansky returned from a vacation in Mexico, customs agents found in his luggage a bottle of ulcer medicine for which he had no prescription. He was arrested for possession of illegal drugs. A judge threw out the charge, but Lansky had had enough.
He decided the best thing was just to get out and to take asylum where every Jew can take asylum, in Israel.
Lansky had always admired Israel. When the Jewish state had been fighting for independence in 1948, Lansky held a fundraiser. He also claimed to have used his New York dock connections to stop arms shipments to the Arabs and reroute the weapons to Israel. Now he believed his loyalty would be rewarded. In June 1970, Lansky and his wife Teddy flew to Tel Aviv. In 1971, the Justice Department summoned him back. After 10 years of investigations, the feds had finally indicted Lansky for the skimming of Las Vegas casinos. In Tel Aviv, Lansky was unconcerned. As he had planned all along, he applied for Israeli citizenship. But at the worst possible moment, Lansky's gangster reputation caught up with him. The Israeli press began to take an interest in this Jewish relic of the mafia world. To escape the press coverage, Lansky moved out of Tel Aviv to a resort hotel on the Mediterranean beach. But the cameras found him there too, just as they had in Miami, out walking his dog. So Lansky granted interviews to reporters in which he claimed he was a victim of media hype.
The newspaper man started a campaign against me, and it snowballed to such an extent that I guess it can't be stopped anymore. I was singled out for some reason. They needed an image. Some newspaper man wrote an article that I have $300 million. Well, I wish I had $1 million.
The controversy meant that Lansky's application for citizenship had to be reviewed by Israel's Interior Minister, Joseph Borg. Borg raised the touchy topic of Lansky one afternoon with his boss, Prime Minister Golda Meir.
Golda Meir apparently had never heard of Meir Lansky. As he started to explain who Lansky was or was thought to be, he said the word mafia, at which Golda Meir stopped him and said, mafia? Mafia? No mafia in Israel.
Israel turned down Lansky's application for citizenship, declaring him a threat to the state. Lansky immediately appealed to the Israeli Supreme Court. Israel needed evidence that Lansky was a threat, and the U.S., which now wanted Lansky back, was happy to help. The Justice Department gave Israel the complete Lansky files.
They had first-hand testimony from witnesses who had seen Lansky beat up somebody or participate in beating up people. So they had a lot of stuff from the 20s and 30s, which had Lansky actually doing a bunch of things, as opposed to just kind of walking his dog, which is what he was doing in the 1970s.
In September 1972, Israel's Supreme Court ruled against Lansky.
Well, so long.
He was ordered to leave the country. Not giving in, Lansky arranged to flee Israel in secret and to bribe officials to smuggle him into hiding in Paraguay. In November 72, Lansky quietly boarded a night flight that would take him to South America. As his jet crossed the Atlantic, the FBI tracked him down. When he arrived in Paraguay, he wasn't allowed to get off the plane.
Every stop that the plane came down to, there was the FBI man standing on the tarmac with the local police chief, making sure that Lansky didn't get off, stayed on the plane,
and was on his way back to, inevitably therefore, to Miami and arrest, where the FBI would let him off the plane and would surely lock him up.
And finally, he shows up in Miami, and of course there's a big arrest, and they can lead him away in handcuffs, and you know, that's the kind of thing the FBI loves.
The government finally had a case against Meyer Lansky, and now it had Lansky himself. The aging mob tycoon would be forced to do battle with his own country in the courtroom. Meyer Lansky's attempted escape to Israel had been thwarted. On November 7, 1972, he was returned to Miami, arrested after landing, and charged with contempt of court and income tax evasion. Lansky's wife, Teddy, arrived in Miami from Tel Aviv 3 days later. Unlike her stoic husband, Teddy Lansky had never gotten used to reporters.
Now look, go away from me, I'll kill you.
When the reporters wouldn't leave her alone, Teddy used a tactic her husband had never tried. She spat on them. The Justice Department was thrilled to have Lansky back in the U.S. For years, he had been a top FBI target, but Lansky had never been convicted of anything more serious than illegal gambling. Now the feds hoped they could put him behind bars for good. Lansky's first trial was for contempt of court. While in Israel, he had failed to show up when summoned to a Miami grand jury. Lansky claimed that his doctor in Israel had forbidden the trip home to testify. But the jury didn't buy it. Lansky was convicted and sentenced to a year in prison, but he remained free on appeal. He still had to stand trial for tax evasion. This case hinged on an unreliable informer, a Boston mobster named Vincent Fat Vinnie Teresa. Teresa told the feds that he had brought illegally skimmed profits from London casinos to mob investors in the States, and he assured his interrogators that on two occasions he had personally given thousands of dollars to Meyer Lansky.
Well, this is the first guy anybody ever testified to putting big amounts of money in Lansky's hands, literally in his hands. And so we were kind of excited about it and started to develop a case.
Mafia turncoats always make tricky witnesses, but Fat Vinnie was the government's best shot at nailing Lansky. The trial began in July 1973. Teresa told the jury that he gave Lansky the mob money on two occasions, both in Miami. But Lansky's lawyer, David Rosen, was able to show that on one of those occasions, Lansky was in Boston. The little man himself, whose increasing frailty kept the trial sessions to a few hours a day, never testified.
He looked like somebody's grandfather, anybody's grandfather. He looked very, very harmless, he certainly didn't look like an organized crime character.
Are you pleased with the way your attorneys handled your defense?
I'm sorry, but no comment.
Well, you can't blame me for asking, can you?
No, I don't blame you at all. I'm with you.
The jury was with Lansky. They acquitted him of taking money from Vinnie Teresa. A third indictment for skimming in Las Vegas was withdrawn. Lansky was too old and sick to stand trial. And in 1974, his conviction for contempt of court was overturned. Meyer Lansky had beaten the law. On the streets of heavily Jewish Miami Beach, Lansky became an elder statesman, a living legend.
The most pious Jews in the world in Miami Beach were the holiest people to whom God is everything. Even God wasn't close to Meyer Lansky. As soon as they saw Meyer Lansky, forget about God, this was God. They used to worship him, follow him, look at him. If he walked down the street, they would talk about how slow he walked, how fast, did he have a dog, a cow, a horse, did he sit down, get up, what time.
One time we're in this little deli down in Miami Beach, and these two young boys came up with yarmulkes on, and they were kind of looking at my grandpa, and I was kind of standing in the background. And they came up and said, "Mr. Lansky, we'd like to get your autograph." And he kind of looks at him seriously, and no, my grandpa goes, "What did I do, an Academy Award?" And I said, "Well, we figured it'll be worth some money someday, Mr. Lansky." And he said, "No, son, I don't sign autographs."
Since the 1960s, Lansky had claimed to be retired. Now, as far as the FBI could tell, he really was.
With all the surveillance that he had on him, he didn't have even the facility to get involved anymore in skimming or any of the other sources of income that he had. And that was, I suppose, the ultimate curse of him living so long, that he outlived his money and had no further way of earning any more.
In 1982, Lansky turned 80. He had developed lung cancer. Joe Varin, his attorney and lifelong friend, pulled a few strings and arranged to restore Lansky's voting rights, lost since his felony conviction in 1950.
and I gave it to him for a birthday present. He said, Joe, that's the best birthday present I ever got in my life.
Meyer Lansky died on November 15th, 1982. There were almost as many reporters at his funeral as there were mourners.
When Lansky died, I don't think he had $300,000 to his name. And that sounds like a lot of money, but it was a mere pittance to a man that made millions.
It was still widely believed that Lansky had millions tucked away somewhere, a Swiss bank account perhaps, but the money never turned up. Meyer Lansky outlived just about every one of his cronies from the heyday of the New York mob, and he did it the old-fashioned way. He kept his mouth shut. Even when he talked, Lansky never gave himself away or gave away any of his partners.
Very, very careful, and very smart. Throughout Lansky's career, if you take him way back from the beginning, he was always two, three steps ahead of everybody else.
Yeah, he liked having an edge, and I think he liked having an edge, especially on people that were legitimate that he was trying to get over on. So, you know, gave him pleasure.
He was a very civilized and a very business-like individual. Lansky.
But though he always said,
right, that's the last of the material that's on BitChute. So there's obviously another part of this somewhere, but it's not available here as far as I can see. But they must be more or less wrapping up now because he's already retired and about to die. So I think that's probably enough for today. For the time being, I'm going to be doing these types of shows for the whole of January, so there'll be shows, breakfast shows. When I'm not doing music, I'll be doing shows about the American mob and money laundering and all of those types of things. So with a bit of luck, there should be enough material to keep me going for the whole of January. Every now and again, I'll take a break and do a music show or a couple of music shows here and there. But there should be enough material, I think, to keep me going for January. So that's as far as I've planned so far. And that's good. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate your company. And I'll see you again. I'll maybe do another one a bit later on today because I'm in the mood for this now. I've had my rest over Christmas, so I'm back in the mood for doing some investigation. All right. Catch you later.